We start off our show today in a conversation with Doug Colbert, who is a professor of law at the University of Maryland School of Law. And on October the 5th, on Tuesday, Judge Alfred Nance had a ruling in his court that really is groundbreaking. And it's that criminal defendants have a right to counsel at their initial bail hearings, which could change the scheme of many things. It's something that our guest, Doug Colbert, has been fighting for years. He was a major part of this case, along with Venable, with a pro bono help from the Venable firm. And we'll talk about that as well and what this actually means. And Doug Colbert, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Good to be here, Mark.
So thanks for stepping away from your daughter's soccer game. We appreciate it. I know how important that is, too.
I'm watching it as we speak, Mark.
So, Doug, let's talk about what this ruling means. I mean, for years we have had this discussion on the air. You've been pushing this idea for a long time. Of ensuring that poor people have representation at their bail hearings when they first step before a judge or a judicial officer after being arrested. So talk about what all this means, what this ruling means.
Well, Mark, it has been 14 years since my law students and I first raised this issue, and actually about the same 14 years since I first appeared on your show and you allowed me to present this issue to your listeners. When people are arrested and they're brought before a judicial officer, a district court commissioner, nowhere in the state of Maryland are the accused represented by an attorney. And here in the city, people are appearing inside the Baltimore City Jail when they first meet the commissioner, and it's left to the individual to try to persuade the commissioner to release the person on bail or to set a bail that's affordable. And as many people understand, the commissioners are and judges are not likely to believe what a person has to say unless that information has been verified. So without a lawyer, our data has shown that when you're charged with a nonviolent crime and you don't have a lawyer, you're five times as likely to remain in jail. And obviously with the lawyer is able to present the information. The judge is then able to make an informed decision. And my law students are examples of lawyers who have represented people in jail. And because of their work in advocacy, they've been able to succeed in almost 70% of their cases.
Now, this is, I mean, what's interesting about this case is, I mean, you and your law students have been doing this for a long time now. But what also came about with this is that Venable, one of the major law firms in the state, in the country, took this on pro bono.
Yes, and the Venable lawyers and law firm have really set an example of what all lawyers ought to be doing. They don't have to take on a case of this magnitude, but every lawyer is required to engage in free pro bono work. And what the law students did about 4.5 years ago is that they made a two-hour presentation to the Venable partners, or at least about a half dozen of the partners, and they persuaded the firm to devote hundreds of hours of free legal assistance. The lawyers from Venable work with myself and with the law students, and together, and it really has been a true collaboration, we were able to file a lawsuit, and actually the lawsuit was filed by Venable in November of 2006. So that's about 4 years ago we filed the suit. When we first appeared before Circuit Court Judge Nance, the judge dismissed our lawsuit and granted a decision in favor of the state, saying that poor people were not entitled to a lawyer when they first appeared. 4 years later, after several developments, including a Supreme Court ruling, Judge Nance ruled in our favor and in his 12-page opinion declared that every poor person has a constitutional and statutory right to representation when their liberty is first at stake.
Now, the significance of this is, I mean, we have been talking and arguing on the show and debating on this program since the beginning of the program almost 17 years ago about the overcrowded conditions in our detention centers in the city and across the state, of the thousands of men and women, mostly men, mostly African-American men, who languish in jail for up to 3, 6 months to a year or more waiting for trial because they could not afford the bail at their bail hearing for nonviolent crimes, for things like urinating in the street, for things like drinking beer in public, for selling a bag of marijuana, whatever it might be. And even though there's a law is being broken, the question is, should people like that spend months and months in jail only to be either nonplussed or let go and found not guilty? So, I mean, talk about what this ruling says in light of that situation that we face, which is also part of the show we did yesterday around juveniles being in adult prisons. The same thing happened to those young men.
Exactly. I mean, I heard yesterday's show, and their parallels are really striking. 9 out of 10 people who are in jail waiting for a trial and not convicted of a crime are African Americans. 9 out of 10. You also have to appreciate, Mark, that most people, when they're charged with a crime, they're charged with nonviolent district court offenses. More than 90% of the people arrested are charged with these nonviolent charges. On average, people spend 40, 45 days in jail before their case is resolved in these district court cases. People do stay longer in jail, as you mentioned, when their cases go on to the circuit court. But we have been focusing on the district court, where most people experience criminal justice. And it's very difficult, whether you're a law student or a lawyer, to explain to someone why they're still staying in jail because they don't have $500 or $300. And they're staying in jail for 40 days on average, a little bit more than 40 days. And then you go to them and you tell them, well, the state has moved to dismiss the case, or the state has moved to put your case on the inactive STET calendar. People who've had jobs, in many cases, have lost their jobs. Students in school have fallen way behind. And we're looking at, not everyone, but we're looking at a lot of people who, if they had representation, I have no doubt that a judge or a commissioner would release them. But because there's nothing reliable, it's like me saying to somebody, I'm a lawyer. Well, if I'm in a jail situation, is that person going to believe me? And that's a very subjective experience. Maybe the commissioner will believe me and won't believe somebody else who doesn't look like me. But the idea is that you should be able to base questions of liberty by ensuring that people have an advocate. That's what the right to counsel means. And Judge Nance, in his opinion, spoke about the liberty interest and said that bail is a critical stage. There's too much at stake here, and the state is going to have to provide a lawyer for every poor and lower-income person.
Now, while we have Doug Colbert here talking about this this new decision by the district court that people have a right to counsel at their initial bail hearings. Number is 410-319-8888. We're going to take a couple calls that come here at 410-319-8888 for Doug Colbert to talk about this before we move on to our guest Dave Zirin and his book, Bad Sports, How Owners Are Ruining the Games We Love, for a little sports talk today. 410-319-8888 is the number here. But, Doug, one of the things in this thing, who's going to defend these people, though? I mean, one of the things that the one article that I read today from the Daily Record quoted the new public defender in Maryland, Paul DeWolf, saying what the old public defender also said, which is, this is great, and we support the suit to have a right to counsel that exists at the bail stage, but they're saying we don't have the resources to represent all the people who would need it, that they are slammed. They don't have they can barely do the work that they do. So who does this?
Okay, so one important point here that I haven't made yet is that this is a decision by a lower court judge. It's a big step forward, and we're much closer to the day when people are going to have a lawyer. But we recognize that we still have a distance to travel. If the state appeals this ruling, we will eventually wind up in the highest court of the state, the Court of Appeals. So while it's a very encouraging sign, the judge put a stay on the order, which means nothing's going to change yet until the state and the public defender decide whether or not to appeal. We're very gratified that the public defender supports our legal position. We're also well aware that the public defender's office is badly under-resourced
right.
and understaffed. The way we would present this issue to the governor, to the legislature, is that assigning lawyers at the first stage is a tremendous cost-saving measure. And when you have a lawyer there at the beginning, the average citizen is not going to be responsible for paying for those 40 or 45 days in jail. It's about $5,000 a person, what we're talking about.
But where will the lawyers come from, is the question.
Well, the lawyers would come, they could come from different places, but the primary responsibility would fall on the public defender. So you're going to have to provide resources for that. But keep in mind, Mark, if I said at the beginning of the program that without a lawyer, you're five times as likely to remain in jail, the public winds up paying millions of dollars that could be saved, and the cost of the lawyers is a fraction of what we would be identifying as cost saving. So by investing in lawyers, you actually wind up saving a lot of money, which in these times, as you know, could be spent a lot more wisely than keeping people who are charged with public urination or driving without a license in jail for an extended period.
Right. And Doug, I want to thank you for doing this today with us, and congratulations on this initial win, this ruling by Judge Alfred Nance. I know to go up through the state court system, it could even go to the federal court system on appeal, but the first step has been taken.
Absolutely, and I thank you very much for the opportunity to be speaking about this issue for this length of time, Mark.
All right, take care, Doug, and good luck on your daughter's soccer game.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We're about to switch gears here and look in the world of sports, but in a very interesting political and social way. As we go there, I'm going to remind you that support for WEAA is provided by Baltimore for Healthy Babies. Far too many babies in Baltimore City die before their first birthdays because they were not sleeping safe. Your baby should always sleep safe, alone, on their back, in a crib. For more information on how to help your baby sleep safe, you can go to healthybabiesbaltimore.com. And we are about to have a conversation with Dave Zirin, who is author of Bad Sports, his latest book, Bad Sports, How Owners Are Ruining the Games We Love. He's host of Edge of Sports Radio on Sirius XM Radio, writes about politics of sports for The Nation magazine and other publications, and we'll be speaking at Red Emma's in Mount Vernon on St. Paul Street this coming Tuesday at 7 p.m. That information will also be on our website. And Dave Zirin, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Hey, it's so great to be back on the show, Mark.
And y'all can join us at 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888. And I'd like to hear your thoughts. It's this question I'm about to ask Dave, and we'll launch into his book, which is called Bad Sports, How Owners Are Ruining the Games We Love, how you would reform sports in our world. And do you think there's such a thing as a good owner? Is there such a thing as a good owner, Dave?
Well, anytime someone asks me who I think the good owner is, I always say it's the 112,000 owners of the Green Bay Packers.
I knew you were going to say that.
I'm sorry, I'm so predictable, but I actually do believe it, that the way the Green Bay Packers are run as a fan-owned entity where one could buy shares of the team, not pull a profit from the team, not pull a dividend from their shares, all they get for it is a piece of paper that they don't even get a frame to put the piece of paper in, and the fact that the team isn't going anywhere, it's staying in Green Bay, the fact that when you buy all the overpriced concessions and beer, which is so so just ever-present at every NFL game, the money actually goes directly back into the community of Green Bay. I think that makes it a team that functions in a way that I'd like to see other teams function.
Of course, that team was owned by the Green Bay and the citizens of Green Bay, and that happened in, 1923. Is that
yes.
right?
That is true. That was back during a time when people would win NFL teams in poker games. I mean, it was a very that's true. The Mara family won the Giants in a card game.
Is that true?
Yes, it is. I mean, this was a bargain basement league. Now, the person who really had the vision to see that in the era of television, the NFL would translate in a much different way was Pete Rozelle, the first commissioner of the National Football League. And he made sure that it was written into the bylaws of the NFL that no other team could be owned in the fashion of the Green Bay Packers, and no nonprofit entity could own an NFL team. Now, these are in the NFL bylaws, and I've been on several sports radio shows where that's been put in my face, saying, you hold up the Green Bay Packers, but it can never happen again. Look at the NFL bylaws. And my response is always, well, wait a minute. Did Moses come down from Mount Sinai with the NFL bylaws? Did the U.S. Congress or the House of Delegates pass the NFL bylaws? Give me a break. I mean, these, if there ever were laws meant to be broken, it's the NFL bylaws.
Well, I mean, in your book, at the end of your book, you talk about that. You said you write that Major League Baseball has banned community ownership. NFL Commissioner Robert Goodell said that they're going to move to keep the ban on nonprofit ownership. Makes logical sense because nonprofits aren't great for profit making groups. I mean, so, but I mean, it's the way they do business.
Yeah, it is the way they do business. But on the other hand, the NFL, and we'll stick with that to just show the hypocrisy here, is also run as a collective entity, remember. They do revenue sharing in the NFL. That's how a team from Green Bay can compete with teams from New York or Dallas or Washington, D.C. It's because they actually pool all the revenue together and divide it evenly, so there's some form of competitive parity. Now, if they can do that, which surely violates the dictates of the profit system and the free market, then surely they can have a team that's run on a more collective basis or on a more fan-friendly basis, because that's what we don't have right now in the NFL. I mean, as much as the NFL is popular in the United States, and I'll say this for all sports, they're not friendly to fans. And I'm not just talking about the $9 beers or the endless commercials or the fact that you can't even look somewhere in a stadium without seeing an ad right in your face. I'm talking about the fact that for far too long, and this is such the story of Baltimore in so many ways, you see the public funding of stadiums with our tax dollars, the public funding of sports through our tax dollars. And it's a way of actually using the fact that we love sports to push through a set of economic policies that otherwise we might oppose.
Folks, I want you to join us here, 410-319-8888. We're talking with Dave Zirin. His book is Bad Sports, How Owners Are Ruining the Games We Love. I know that this station here is full of folks who love to go to see Washington play, Washington fans, Orioles fans, Ravens fans. So, and I know we always see those racist coats running around here with the Washington name on it. But everybody loves the Washington team. But join us with your thoughts.
The only team named after an ethnic slur.
Right, exactly. Exactly. And
actually, I get into that a little bit in the book, too. Actually,
you do.
Because there's something, I think a lot of people who root for the Redskins, and I know this, actually, because I live in D.C., I mean, don't know the history of that name. I mean, the fact that they're called the Redskins because the team was once owned by a segregationist named George Preston Marshall, and they were the last team to integrate in the NFL. And when he moved the team to Washington, they were the southernmost team in the National Football League. And so he was making direct and abject appeals to both white southern racism and to minstrelsy. I mean, the original Redskin fight song, now it ends Fight for Old D.C. It used to be Fight for Old Dixie.
Really?
Yes.
That's interesting. I'll have to.
Yeah, and you know, and I'll tell you something. It's like one of the reasons why I believe in public ownership of teams is that I really think that as long as Dan Snyder owns the Redskins, first of all, they're always going to be terrible, which is one of the problems, because I just think he's the incredible example of just the worst of what pro sports ownership has to offer is Mr. Daniel Snyder. But also, I think we're never going to see the name really change unless the public really does get to have some say in it, because I don't think most Redskins fans are racist. I don't think that for a second. But I do think that we've become kind of calloused and inured to the actual history behind the name, and also how offensive it is to people of indigenous descent, not to mention people who have a sense of anti-racist perspective.
So all you Prince George's County and Montgomery County, D.C. listeners, what do you think? Bass, you're standing across the glass. What do you think, man? You are, you know, a Washington man. So 410-319-8888 is the number here to join in this conversation. And I want to, before we come back to D.C. and spend some time with Snyder and what he's done to Washington, we're broadcasting from Baltimore, and you have a whole chapter on Peter Angelos and the Orioles.
Got to.
It is.
Absolutely got to.
I mean, here you have a man, as you write about in the beginning of that chapter, who made his money, his hundreds of millions of dollars, fighting for workers' rights, fighting against big corporations, fighting for the right of the players' union to take on the owners and back the players' union. What happened?
Back in 1994.
Right.
I mean, I think what happened is that Peter Angelos started to believe his own hype. And I quote him in the book saying things like, why can't we be the Yankees? And he's basically saying, why can't I be George Steinbrenner? Why can't I be that kind of larger-than-life owner who, due to the largesse that I'm gaining through my incredible stadium, Camden Yards, at Oriole Park at Camden Yards, why can't we be players in the free agent market? Why can't we sign people to ridiculous contracts and use that method as a way to compete with the Yankees year in, year out? And, of course, when the Orioles were hot back in 96 and 97 in particular, it seemed like that actually had some currency. And he was, you know, at one point, I believe he was Baltimoreans' man of the year. They said he was going to be the man of the decade of the 1990s. No one's saying that now. Because there's something very, you know, Baltimore is not just not New York City. And there's something very precious about what once was called the Oriole way. I mean, this idea of building up the team methodically through
right.
your farm system. And building and having a product, not just a product, but also having players that a hardscrabble city could really be proud of. And you know, I see this, my wife's from the Baltimore area, and I see this with her and her family. I mean, people who grew up absolute diehard Oriole fans who could just care less about the team today. I mean, they've just been completely alienated from it. And if you look at Camden Yards, of course, I mean, when I moved to the area, which was in 1996, I mean, that was the toughest ticket in town. You had better chance to get backstage at a top rock concert than you did of getting into Camden Yards. And yet today, of course, you could have a conversation with somebody across the stadium. You just, you know, just start talking to them. I mean, it's really something to behold. And as I talk about in the book, I mean, Camden Yards is also in a lot of ways the prototype copied so often by dozens of cities in this country that spread a lie that said the building of a stadium can change a city and change a neighborhood, which is, I argue in the book, and I'm backed up by a lot of hard facts on this, is kind of a fiction that's been perpetrated about the relationship between Camden Yards and the waterfront in Baltimore and Camden Yards and the city of Baltimore.
Well, that, you know, this comes in the beginning of your book, and actually it winds its way all through the book, but the very idea that domes, that the building of stadiums is something that has become commonplace in America.
Yes.
Baltimore is the first place where the city was kind of held hostage to build these stadiums.
No, that's absolutely correct because of the experience, of course, of the Baltimore Colts leaving to Indianapolis.
Right.
And this is, you know, this is the kind of the psychic scar on the city that existed until the Ravens really came. But then, of course, taking a team from Cleveland and ripping their guts out. But this is the terrible irony of all this. But this is the thing about the Baltimore Colts story, which I found that a lot of people, even in Baltimore, didn't know the full extent of this story. I mean, everybody knows about the villainous Bob Irsay and the Mayflower trucks that took taking the team in the dead of night from Baltimore to Indianapolis. But what a lot of people don't know, which is very significant, what a lot of people just do not know, is that the team itself, it was so obvious that Irsay was going to take the team to Indianapolis, that the Maryland House of Delegates actually voted to seize the team. They voted that they were going to actually seize the team from Bob Irsay and put it basically in receivership, claim eminent domain, and say, you know what, this team is actually the property of the city of Baltimore and the state of Maryland.
Mm.
And how dramatic would that have been if they'd been able to get away with that? How that would have changed the NFL bylaws, how that would have changed the whole last, frankly, 25 years when the building of stadiums has really become a substitute for anything resembling an urban policy in this country.
It's true. That's a sad, it's sad but true.
Sad but true. My goodness. I mean, think about it. I mean, you've had, think of cities like Cleveland, Milwaukee, Detroit, Pittsburgh, Oakland. What they all have in common is high unemployment, a completely eroded, if not destroyed, manufacturing base and industrial base, and these beautifully built stadiums.
And you have, I mean, the one city that seemed to stand up lost its team.
Yeah, that's
that
right.
You write about.
That's right. Yeah, I talk about the Seattle Sonics.
Now the Thunder.
Now the Oklahoma City Thunder, as they're sometimes referred to, the Zombie Sonics. And what's particularly painful about it is that the Thunder are an incredibly exciting, dynamic team. And their star player, Kevin Durant, who some would argue is the best player in the National Basketball Association today, even better than LeBron James, he won the scoring title this year at 21. He said in an interview just a couple weeks ago, he said, look, I love my team, I love my teammates, but wow, I miss Seattle. And frankly, who living in Oklahoma City wouldn't miss Seattle?
I have spent a lot of time.
Here.
I spent a lot of time in Oklahoma City for a certain period of my life for some work I had to do there. And it is, I mean, the town doesn't have sidewalks.
Yeah. And the streets that are there, most of them are named after the Gaylord family, as I'm sure you're aware. This is one of the most
It's in your book.
Schmancy suburbs is called Gaylordia, is its nicknamed, like the schmanciest suburb out there. And the Gaylord family, the daughter married a gentleman by the name of Clay Bennett, and he was the person who bought the team in Seattle and moved them to Oklahoma City in what was just pure thievery and utter dishonesty. And I chart his dishonesty in the book. And one of the arguments I make is like, yo, we got to change the entire paradigm here. We got to change this whole argument as it now exists, where your choices are either you build a new stadium with public money or you lose the team. We got to change it to say, you know what, if you're threatening to take the team, then we're going to sue to claim the team, to seize the team, because the Seattle Sonics belonged to Seattle long before they ever belonged to Clay Bennett.
You know, when we're going to take a short break in a minute here, and I want to come back. I want to come back to certain chapters in your book and really talk about Dick DeVos and the Walmart way and why Steinbrenner was the bridge and things like that. But I also want to just explore what has happened to sports and why what caused the shift from even when it was an owner-based industry for the Colts of the 50s and the Giants of the 50s and the and the Orioles of the 50s and 60s, and something twisted and turned. I'd like to get your analysis of what that was. And
absolutely.
Get our listeners in here at 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888. 8888's number here. Join us with Dave Zirin, author of Bad Sports, Owners are running, ruining the games we love. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. Dave Zirin is our guest for the rest of the hour. He is author of Bad Sports, How Owners Are Ruining the Games We Love. He's the host of Edge of Sports Radio on Sirius XM Radio. You can also hear him with Bob Edwards on Sirius as well. Writes about politics of sports for The Nation and other publications. And this Tuesday night at 7 p.m., he'll be over at Red Emma's in Mount Vernon over on St. Paul Street. And you can get all that information on our website and also link on to Red Emma's website. Join us here at 410-319-8888. So what do you think happened? What's your analysis of what happened, Dave, about where sports flipped and where it changed? I mean, I'm old enough to have grown up in an era when the people who played for your team were identified with the city and they actually stayed in the city. There was very little trading going on. Some, but it was just beginning. Something flipped.
Yeah, I mean, what flipped was where the money came from. Like, a lot of people would answer that question by just saying the money. Like, more money. It became a bigger business. Players got paid more. And I think that's way too simplistic. What really changed was where the money came from. Because it didn't matter who you were as an owner. You could be a good guy, a bad guy, a jerk, you know, or you could, you know, you could pet puppies or you could throw puppies out windows. It didn't matter. At the end of the day, if you were going to make money as an owner, you had to sell tickets. Ticket sales governed all. Even TV wasn't that much money back then.
Right.
Yet, over the last, I would say, 30 years, what makes a successful team has literally nothing to do with how many tickets you sell. I mean, fans have become scenery. The only time we matter is when it becomes embarrassing that there aren't more of us there. Like, for example, when the Tampa Bay Devil Rays just made the playoffs and players were embarrassed that nobody was actually at the stadium to watch them. But there's no incentive for team owners to get them there and to cater to fans because the money's been replaced by three dominant revenue sources. The first is the one we talked about, this idea of publicly funding stadiums. That's become a major revenue source that governs all concerns. The second is sweetheart cable deals from cable television. I mean, this is what makes, for example, the Yankees have such a crushing financial advantage over every other team. They have a $400 million cable deal. So even if they're spending like $180, $200 million on their players, which is 10 times more than what the Pittsburgh Pirates pay their team, they are still making money hand over fist because of the cable industry. And by the way, there's a lot to say about this that's not fan-friendly. The way if you don't have the right cable package, you
right,
can't see the game, even though we're paying for the stadiums. So there's that aspect. And then the third thing is this idea of catering to, you could call them the corporate fan. So what you do is you have these personalized seat licenses or PSLs, or you have this thing, these luxury boxes at the stadiums. And oftentimes, people buy these, well, corporations, they buy them, and oftentimes they don't even use them. And that's a pretty dispiriting sight as a fan when you're in the nosebleed seats and you see empty boxes or empty front row seats. That kind of stinks. But what it means, though, is that the demographic of who, as David Stern calls them, the commissioner of the NBA, who the quote-unquote ticket-buying fan is very different than what it used to be 20, 30 years ago.
Dave Zirin's with us, talking about his latest book, Bad Sports, How Owners Are Ruining the Games We Love. And these owners, they're very special and different breed.
Oh, yeah.
Let's talk about some of these folks that you write about. I mean, when you write about the owner of the Orlando Magic, Dick DeVos.
I mean, Dick DeVos.
I got to tell you, until I read your book, I didn't pay attention to this stuff that much. I didn't pay attention to who Dick DeVos was and as an owner of Orlando Magic and what he stands for.
Well, it's remarkable how many of these owners, like, I mean, most of them are politically to the right of center. Some of them are to the right of Genghis Khan. And as far as I'm concerned, I don't care what their politics are. I mean, this is still America, at least it is as of today. And as far as I'm concerned, people can believe whatever they want to believe. The problem, though, is that a lot of these owners, they use the fact that their stadiums are publicly funded, and they use them as almost like a money laundering operation where public dollars go into the stadium, then they come out the other end underwriting think tanks, underwriting legal organizations, underwriting individuals who stand for some of the most far-right ideas in our society, far-right on social issues, economic issues. And that's what upsets me, because to me, sports ideally should be a political space. And yet when you buy a ticket to an Orlando Magic game, or when you get the cable package, I should say, or if you're a taxpayer and could care less about basketball in the state of Florida, $480 million going to Dick DeVos. Dick DeVos underwrites Focus on the Family, the Family Research Council, the Media Research Council. I mean, groups that I list them in the book. I mean, they stand for everything from reparative therapy for gays and lesbians to changing the Constitution and restoring it with the Ten Commandments. I mean, real loopy stuff. And yet Dick DeVos, even though he loves the Ten Commandments, he does covet, believe me. And one of the things that he covets is money for his own family. And one of the things I talk about in the book is that Dick DeVos, his son Dick Jr., married into another billionaire's family named the Prince family. And the patriarch of that family, Edgar Prince, has been friends with Dick DeVos for decades and decades. Edgar Prince had two kids. One was named Betsy Prince, and she's the one who married Dick DeVos's son. And his other child is named Eric Prince, the CEO of Blackwater. Blackwater, during the 2000s, got roughly $700 million in government contracts. Dick DeVos, during that time, was the largest single donor to the Bush administration in their reelection campaigns. I mean, you see how this stuff then begins to work. I mean, he funds to make sure that Dick DeVos gets his contract. I mean, sorry, that Eric Prince gets his contracts, and then proceed to maraud several countries throughout the world as the subcontracted private army.
It's a frightening thought. I'm going to go through some more of these owners and talk about the Walmart way and many other things here in the course of the time we have left with Dave Zirin and his book, Bad Owners. 410-319-8888. 410-319-8888 is the number here. And let's go to Tommy in Baltimore. You're on the air.
How you doing?
Hi, Tommy. You're on the air.
Yeah, okay, thank you. I think the author is really on to something. I think he's on to a whole lot that a lot of people don't even realize. Now, when you speak about Washington Redskins and the fact that the name, what the name really means, and people really don't know what it is, there's a highway over there that comes right out of Washington, goes into Virginia. It's called Indian Head Highway. And that was done specifically to send a message, which has really never got that far into the psyche of the people in Washington. Now, when you come forward and you come to Baltimore, and Stan, and you talk about the Colts and the Ravens and the Orioles, and like there's another dynamic that's in play, and Stan, that might help the people understand that the current owners of the Orioles, yeah, they're going to take a loss, but it's going to be a beneficial loss tax-wise and otherwise. But they're in for a big, tremendous windfall that's coming in. And they've known this for a long while. I don't know whether you've got the chutzpah to go into it. You understand? But they knew exactly what they were doing. They put those two stadiums there. They knew exactly what they were doing in the time frame. They were regenerating and restructuring the layout of the city to run it from Washington, D.C. through PG County up to Anne Arundel County into Baltimore City and up the Potomac, up to the Pennsylvania line. Now, if you can get into that and you got enough chutzpah, brother, you got a second and a third book.
Dave Zirin?
I get into it in this book. And,
yes, you do.
I appreciate your use of the word chutzpah, both correctly and in context. So well done, sir. But I will say this. I talk about it in great detail, and what I call these stadiums, and this relates directly to your question, or your comments, I should say, I call them neoliberal Trojan horses, because it's not just about a stadium scam, it's not just about getting money for the owner, it's about changing urban policy, because what does a stadium bring? It's not just that it brings tourists and whatnot, it also changes our conception of what is a good working-class job. So instead of looking for like that manufacturing job or that union job on the docks, what you're looking at now is service industry jobs. You're looking at jobs that pay less. You're looking at jobs that are less secure. You're looking at jobs that are more difficult to organize. You're looking at jobs with a higher turnover rate. And you're making that the new reality for working people in our cities. That's not just Baltimore. That's the story across this country. And stadiums are a part of facilitating that process. They're essential to it.
And you talk about United Workers and their struggle here in Baltimore in the stadiums.
Absolutely. And I believe that the United Workers are also going to show up to the event at Red Emma's. So I really hope people come out Tuesday so you can meet some of these
people. No, it'll be great. Tuesday night, Red Emma's, 7 p.m. He'll be speaking there. And his book, of course, I missaid it a moment ago. It's not Bad Owners. It's what Bad Owners in a sense. But the book is called Bad Sports, How Owners Are Ruining the Games We Love. Let's talk for a minute about the unholy gall of the Paulsons, one of the shorter chapters in the book, but...
Absolutely. It's a very short chapter, but I honestly couldn't resist. I had to get it in there because there's something about the way that public stadiums are built in this country where the debt is socialized and the profit is privatized. And the socialization of debt, the privatization of profit, and this is what has been going on with these stadiums for 25 years. And I make the case in the book that I really do believe that this has kind of inured us and calloused us over and deadened us when they did the bank bailouts at the very end of the Bush administration and spent $700 billion plus, so put it over $1 trillion, to bail out the banks. and this idea that, well, we're going to socialize the crisis, but it's not like the public is then going to be able to have ownership of the banks. No, no, no. Once the banks are solvent, they're immediately back in private hands. And I feel like sports has, in a lot of ways, prepared the mindset that allowed that to happen. Now, who, of course, was the person who was behind that was the Treasury Secretary under George W. Bush, a gentleman by the name of Henry Paulson, or King Henry, as Time magazine called him. King Henry's son is a gentleman by the name of Merritt Paulson, about as ridiculous a name as one could possibly imagine. You might as well name him Privilege. Name him in Merritt. Achieve nothing on Merritt. My goodness, he's the son of a man who's got over $100 million in the bank. Now, Merritt Paulson is someone who has attempted, and he's actually just recently the die has been cast, and he's failed at this. But he has tried to get public money for a stadium out in Portland, and Portland is a city that a lot of people think is like kind of this hippie Pacific Northwest city. It actually has one of the highest child poverty rates in the country, and yet still he wanted the public funds to build a stadium for a minor league franchise, for no less. So this is who Merritt Paulson is. And that's why I call it the unholy gall of the Paulsons, because Merritt Paulson owns 2/3 of this minor league baseball team out there. Guess who owns the other third? His father, Hank, the Treasury Secretary. It's like he hasn't taken enough money from us. He needs a little extra. So it's almost like he couldn't enjoy the sporting event unless he knew it was being paid for by the public dime.
Now, the contrast between Jerry Colangelo, who owns the Arizona Diamondbacks, and the Phoenix Suns. Same state.
Pretty, and Colangelo used to be the owner of the Diamondbacks as well. I mean, used to be the owner of the Suns.
Of the Suns as well, right.
Yeah, used to own all the sports teams there, and Colangelo is a very right-wing individual. I mean, he's the first, and he put a ton of money into this thing called the Presidential Prayer Team in 2004. As part of George W. Bush's reelection campaign. I mean, this is hucksterism, plain and simple. Buying hundreds of thousands of dollars of radio ads throughout the country to say, now is the time to drop to your knees and pray for George W. Bush and Laura Bush. Like, don't forget Laura Bush. We have to pray for her, too, and pray for their reelection. So this is who Jerry Colangelo is, and this is what he stands for. And he's also taken a ton of public money, and so is the new owner of the Diamondbacks, a gentleman by the name of Ken Kendrick. He holds fundraisers for the very people who pushed through SB 1070, the horrific racial profiling laws in the state of Arizona. He holds fundraisers for them in the owner's box at the stadium where the Diamondbacks play, even though it was built with public dollars. So during games, they're having fundraisers for these guys in what was a publicly paid-for stadium. That's who Ken Kendrick is. Meanwhile, though, you have the Phoenix Suns, who as a team led by Steve Nash, came out against SB 1070 in some actions that really were quite dramatic during Cinco de Mayo in the playoffs last year in the NBA.
You know, one of the things you say in the beginning of the book when you talk about Washington, D.C., for a bit, you talk about how billionaires, some of the richest men in America, took $1 billion from one of the poorest cities in America, being Washington, D.C.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, this is where I live. I'm 10 minutes from there right now as we're having this discussion. At the $1 billion stadium, it's where the Washington Nationals play. It's been an utter disaster, I mean, both in terms of the team and in terms of the way in which it was supposedly going to revitalize the neighborhood. And what can you really say about it, except 66% of the city was against it, and there was a poll that was funded actually by supporters of the stadium. And yet, you know, and we pay a real price for that in this town. I mean, 5 minutes from where I live, the Metro went off the tracks a little over a year ago. 9 people died, and they found out in the subsequent investigation that there were Metro trains that hadn't been refurbished since Jimmy Carter was president. And this is the reality of Washington, D.C. And so you're talking about very real choices that were made. Stadiums were built. The Metro was not refurbished. They always say there's no money for schools in this town. Certainly Michelle Rhee loves saying that. And yet here's the answer right in front of your face. Is this stadium and about the priorities of a city that was more serious about serving corporate and development interests than about serving the interests of the people who live here? And I would argue it gets particularly pronounced in D.C. because of the absence of democracy here.
Right. A government that's not represented.
Exactly.
And, right, it is a surf city, in many ways, and I don't spell it, and I don't mean by the ocean.
Yeah, you don't mean Jan and Dean.
Right. But here's the issue here. When I go through this book, I love the way you write, and you bring out some incredible stuff, facts that I've never even thought about. When it comes to the owners of these teams, but it seems like they have us all over a barrel. That even when people protested in Maryland when they wanted to build the stadiums at public expense, were opposed to it. As you just described what happened in D.C., look what happened in Seattle. That the power of the corporate dollar.
It's very intense. It's very intense. But I think the first thing that we need to do is change the terms of the debate. I think that's so totally vital for this. Like I said before, it's like I think if we were able to protest and start raising demands, not for the stadium to not be built, but to say, okay, if you're going to put public funds into it, then we demand partial or full public ownership, and to make owners have to comment on that. And because there's a logic to it, which I think can connect with people, even sports fans, because what they do is they're very clever. They paint us as being what? Anti-sports.
Right.
And, oh, you're trying to get rid of the Orioles. Oh, the end of this is we're going to end up like the Supersonics and not have a team anymore. It's like, well, no, let's reframe it and say we want sports, but we're not going to be corrupted to play them. We're not going to have our lives destroyed for the privilege of having sports.
I mean, you have this great quote, I'm trying to find the book, of one of the sportscasters who talks about, stop talking about the business of baseball. Let's just talk about the game.
Yeah, that's Jason Starks.
Right, Jason Starks, right.
He says, jeepers, creepers, why do we need to talk about all this business stuff? He says, can't we just love the game and enjoy the game and the beauty of the game? And I would just make the case, first of all, it's a little hard to do that when, A, you can't afford tickets, B, the game's an hour longer than it was a generation ago because there are more commercials, C, when you get assaulted from every which way with ads and loud music so you can't enjoy it with your kids. All of these things are actually impediments to enjoying the game. And so one of the arguments about my book is, like, it's not an anti-sports book at all. I mean, we're in a project of trying to reclaim sports. I mean, I think that owners, they're about is short-term profit and not looking at the long-term interests of what's in the best interest of their sport. It's particularly true in baseball. I just feel like they're turning off a generation of fans.
Well, you know, and people, I was thinking about this the other day as I was reading your book, and the last Orioles game I went to, we got some free tickets, so we went. A friend of ours gave us tickets, and we went to see the game. And we were sitting behind the Orioles dugout, just a few rows back. Great seats. Of course, there's hardly a bad seat in Camden Yards, but it was great seats. And the tickets were free. I can imagine what they must have cost if I had to pay for them. But still, to get out the door, to buy a few beers, a Coke, a hot dog for friends, we spent $75.
Unbelievable. And you thought you were going for free.
I mean, it was just for a beer and a couple of hot dogs.
Yeah. No, it's true. And not every stadium has this rule, but a lot of stadiums, of course, have the rule of no outside food, and they'll check your bag to make sure that that stays the case.
So it's difficult to get a groundswell on this, though, isn't it? I mean, you come up with some interesting ideas at the end of the book, but it's hard.
It is difficult to get a groundswell for the simple reason that a lot of people have honestly voted with their feet and just said, ugh, I hate sports, I don't like it. Other people, you know, in the era of TiVo and cheap flat-screen TVs, have just said, yeah, I'll enjoy it from home, and I won't deal with any of the BS. But I think that whether you're a sports fan or not, we're affected by this. I mean, Ralph Nader has this quote that he likes to say where he says, you better turn on to politics or politics will turn on you. I think people really have to turn on to sports and how sports are being used in our communities, or sports are really going to turn on us.
Well, they have in some ways. I think that's one of the reasons that even though there are often greater issues in an NFL or an NBA player strike or during the contract negotiations that affect more people than just the players themselves, and also affects things the long-term players in terms of bottom lines, how people are paid in the leagues and who makes the money, that people are so turned off to both the owners, to the commercialization of the game, and to the salaries that they have walked away from all that.
That's true. That is true, and it's especially true if you look at some of the attendance at both baseball and NBA games. I mean, it really is crazy how sparse it's become. And part of it is that owners don't care, except when, you know, it looks embarrassing. That's the only time they really care. That's why I say in the book, it's like we've become like scenery.
I'm just curious, are the attendance rates in Green Bay any different?
Well, no, the NFL attendance rates largely are very good. Although this year, they're at, in Green Bay, yeah, Green Bay has sold out for years. But actually this year, the NFL is dealing with actually a crisis because attendance is dropping largely due to the recession. I mean, it's dropping roughly 1% or 2%. And you might say, well, that's not such a big deal, but it matters because the NFL has this very archaic thing that's been on the books for about 35 years, 40 years, called the blackout rule, which
All
means
right.
that if not enough people buy tickets, well, the game just isn't shown on local television. Even if you have an NFL satellite, it's not shown. You can't see it, which was scary because that means the NFL somehow has the power to go into space and block a satellite feed. That just scares me for some reason. But this is the reality. So a lot of these stadiums, once again, that we're paying for with our own dollars, we can't even watch it on TV because people are staying at home. So, you know, this was actually going to happen at the opening night of the Meadowlands when it debuted. And the new Meadowlands where the Jets and the Giants play cost of over $1.5 billion. And so what the owner of the Jets, a person who's a very right-wing, a gentleman by the name of Woody Johnson from the Johnson & Johnson fortune, he actually bought thousands of tickets with his own money so it could be shown on local TV because of what a PR disaster that really would have been.
Are there any progressive, liberal, left-wing owners anywhere?
I mean, it's interesting. You have to search far and wide, but Mark Cuban.
Well, you do see Mark Cuban as your favorite of them all, right.
He probably is. I mean, just because I like him because, yes, he's bombastic. Yes, he's obnoxious. Yes, he's kind of an overpaid frat boy thing going on. But the cool thing about Mark Cuban is, first of all, he doesn't do what I find totally repellent, which is act like he knows more than everybody else. Like, there's actually a division of labor where the general manager of that team, a gentleman named Donnie Nelson, makes all the decisions, and Mark Cuban just does his thing and acts wacky. But he also underwrites a lot of very interesting movies and documentaries like The Smartest Guys in the Room, the Enron documentary.
Right.
Good Night and Good Luck, the film about McCarthy and Edward R. Murrow. This is Mark Cuban's money he puts into those kinds of projects. I find that kind of interesting.
This has been just fascinating. Let me just say that Dave Zirin, author of Bad Sports, How Owners Are Ruining the Games We Love, will be at Red Emma's Bookstore and Cafe this coming Tuesday night, 800 St. Paul Street, 7 p.m., 410-230-0450 for more information. It's very easy to get to, right down on St. Paul by Mount Vernon, 800 block of St. Paul Street at Red Emma's. Come visit and hear Dave Zirin. It'll be a great night. He's a great speaker and very lively. And have a good cup of coffee and everything else as well. Dave, thank you so much.
My privilege, Mark. Be well.
Always great to talk to you. Folks, we're going to take a brief break and come back. When we do, we're going to be visiting with a U.S. Army veteran who did two tours of duty in Iraq, a member of Iraq Veterans Against the War, because this is the 10th anniversary of the beginning of the war, and we're going to hear what they have to say about what they're going to do. You can join us here at 410-319-8888. Stay with us. We'll be right back.